I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The Bush administration welcomed the formation of a new interim government in Iraq today. Speaking just moments ago at the White House, President Bush described it as an important first step for Iraq.
The naming of the new interim government brings us one step closer to realizing the dream of millions of Iraqis, a fully sovereign nation with a representative government that protects their rights and serves their needs.
Earlier today, the head of Iraq's governing council, Ghazi Mashal Ajil al-Yawar, was named president of the interim government after the U.S.-backed candidate turned down the job. For more on who's in and who's out, we turn to Orly Halpern, who is in Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Orly.
Hi.
This is a 26-member government now, which will be taking the place of the Iraqi Governing Council. So who will be in charge, and is this a government that people think can work?
That is an excellent question. Basically, the man in charge is the man that the Governing Council appointed, who really the U.S.-led coalition wanted, and that is Dr. Ayed Alawi. He is the man, and he is the one's the main person making the decisions about who is in his government. Surprisingly, he seems to have more sway in that than even the Americans do. And will it work is a very good question. No one is quite sure if it will work. We have yet to see. There is a very diverse group of people. Some of them are technocrats, and some of them are not. Some of them are there for just to satisfy political desires of different groups. So it is very difficult to say at this point if it will succeed.
Well, tell us a bit more about the job of president. This is largely symbolic. So give us a line or two on that, and also how that contrasts with the job of prime minister. And
well, yes, as you said, it is a largely a symbolic job, but it was important that it be someone who is from the Sunni Muslims in the country and no one else. The person that the Americans wanted was a very respectable statesman type, and the man who got the job was much younger and much more popular. He has a lot more backing. He comes from one of the largest tribes in the country, and here people are very supportive of people from their own tribe. So that already gives him a lot of support. And also, he has been very vocal about his opposition to the control of the American-led coalition in the country.
There were two bombings today as well. Were those seen as a signal of discontent with this new government, or is that simply more of the violence that we've been seeing for quite some time?
It's basically the usual violence. Often when there is something symbolic happening, for example, when there was the signing of the Constitution back in March, the same thing happened. There were mortar attacks on the Green Zone, as it is called, the night before. And again, we have seen that today.
And what are you hearing from Iraqis yet? As you say, it's a pretty delicate balance of power in terms of how each of these groups are represented. Do people seem to feel so far that they got it about right?
Yes and no. For the most part, the Iraqis say it doesn't really matter. We didn't choose these people. They were basically chosen by the Americans and by Dr. Alawi himself. The Iraqi people had no say in this, so it really doesn't matter to us who got it. It wasn't our choice. But on the other hand, there was a lot of basically happiness over the choice of the president. A lot of people could relate to him because he wears a typical Arab garb, tunic, a headdress, and he is seen more as a local than some of the other people that were up for the job.
All right, Orly, thank you. We'll be watching it as you will.
Thank you.
Orly Halpern reports for the Christian Science Monitor. And we now turn to reporter Vivian Walt, who interviewed UN Special Envoy Lakhdar Brahimi for the current issue of Time magazine. As you recall, Brahimi helped put together the interim government. And Vivian, can we say that at least as of this morning, if not democracy, at least a consensus government now exists in Iraq?
It's, I would say, even hard to say that. It came down to three bodies trying to reach a consensus: the Governing Council, the U.S. administration, and the U.N. So to find a consensus between three people was just immensely complicated, as Brahimi told me. And ultimately, it seemed to me that Brahimi lost the battle of what he was trying to do.
Well, the candidate was who was chosen for president was not Brahimi's first choice, not America's choice either. Where did he come from, and why was it important and perhaps even critical that he was not an American choice?
He has to be seen, Gail, not to be the U.S.'s man. That is the most important thing for this government, is not to have that be brushed with that taint that the Governing Council has suffered from for a year of being Washington's, you know, proxy government. So in that respect, he is a good choice. He is a tribal sheikh. He represents a large tribe which cuts across national boundaries and represents Sunni and Shia Muslims. So in that respect, he will be a popular choice in the Arab world.
But you say he wasn't Brahimi's first choice either. Why not, and should we be concerned about that?
Brahimi really wanted Adnan Pachachi, as did the U.S. government, and in some respects Adnan Pachachi would have been a better choice. He's a veteran diplomat and politician, is very well connected all over the world. He happens to be an old friend of Brahimi himself, and I think that he just was too much seen as a Western man.
Well, tell us a bit about Brahimi's role here, because he has been clearly the man to see in the past several weeks. Can what he has helped put together hold?
Well, I think it's going to take a lot of hand-holding, both by the U.S. and by the U.N. When I saw Brahimi a few days ago, he seemed, to be honest, exhausted to me. And not that optimistic. He did think that the country would hold together as a unified entity, but I think he was extremely worried that the violence just wouldn't subside after June. And if that's the case, that means serious involvement from Washington. And unfortunately for this government, the one thing that they can do to gain credibility is to rein in the American troops. If they cannot do that, they really will be distrusted by a lot of Iraqis.
You describe Brahimi as a soothing figure for some of Iraq's nervous neighbors. How so?
Well, for one thing, he is of the region, and that's critically important for the region. He's Algerian. He's got a long history of having been involved in the War of Liberation in Algeria. So in that respect, he was definitely a good choice for this role.
Hmm. And finally, Vivian, you note in your article that Star Wars is his favorite movie. What does that tell us about him?
Well, he is a fun guy, strangely enough. I mean, when you meet him, he's terribly serious and mumbles a lot. You know, he's a man of the world. He has a home in Paris. He has studied part of the time in the U.S. He is somewhat, you know, hip to the modern world, albeit at 70 years old.
Vivian, thank you.
You're welcome.
Vivian Walt covers Baghdad for the Boston Globe and Time magazine.
Up to 7,000 United Nations troops are set to arrive for a peacekeeping mission in Haiti today, gradually swapping places with American troops already there. As the poorest nation in the hemisphere grapples with political unrest and the aftermath of last week's floods that killed nearly 1,700. Stephen Dudley covers Haiti for the Boston Globe. He is in Port-au-Prince right now. Stephen, what are the UN troops expected to do in Haiti?
First and foremost, the United Nations will be here to maintain some semblance of order, to provide some sort of security for Haitian citizens.
Tell us about that. Who is maintaining order in Haiti?
Well, essentially right now, it's a hodgepodge of different groups, most importantly 1,800 United States troops that are based here in Port-au-Prince. They've teamed up with another 2,000 or so troops from different countries, and they're keeping some semblance of order right now. There is a police force. However, the police force is a little bit ragged, you might say. When the revolts hit in February, many of the police simply disappeared. They haven't really come back. So they're trying to reconstruct the police force, and in the interim, they're going to have an international presence, and that is essentially the United Nations.
Stephen, what problems will any military presence confront? We know this is such an impoverished country. They've actually been baking mud crackers to eat. What are the problems there?
Well, you have to begin with the idea that nearly six of the country's 8 million people live below the poverty line, and the country is literally slipping into the ocean. I mean, the earth is falling into the ocean. 90% of the country is deforested. So where do you go from there? How do you reconstruct the country that is literally slipping into the ocean? So the problems are immense. The United Nations group that is coming in, however, will maintain or try to focus mostly on trying to reconstruct the security force so there is a minimum of security while a new government begins to set the pace.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has asked member nations to make a long-term commitment to Haiti. This is a country that has suffered 30 coups in the last two centuries, and they are only getting a fraction of the money that he's asked for. What are Haitians saying about the prospect of this working?
Haitians are resilient people. They face up to their difficulties. As you pointed out, you know, many of them have to smile through what are very difficult life circumstances. Having said that, I think they carry very little hope that another presence or another United Nations tour through here, or even another United States tour through here, is really going to make that much difference to them. You know, they're very cynical with regard to international aid because, as you pointed out, it seems to be piecemeal.
Yeah, Stephen, some say that it's complete chaos in Haiti, that different factions are running different parts of the country, that the soldiers who overthrew Aristide are still running parts of the country. There are gangs roaming in other parts. How tough a job is this going to be for any military?
It's going to be very tough, and to be honest with you, you know, much of what you just described is actually more bubbling under the surface than out in the open. I mean, while the United Nations are here, maybe these people will lay below the surface and everything, but once the United Nations, and even once the United States leaves, there's the question of whether or not they will reemerge, and when they reemerge, how they will reemerge, and in what form, and if they will reemerge in a violent way. And that's really the big question for Haitians. Sure, there's going to be an international presence right now, but what happens once the international presence is gone?
Stephen Dudley reports for the Boston Globe. He spoke to us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, we speak to former Republican Senator Lowell Weicker about the late Sam Dash and Archibald Cox.
And later, trying to make sense of the drug discount card program.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Two titans of the Watergate years passed away last Saturday. Archibald Cox was the special prosecutor investigating the scandal, fired by President Richard Nixon in what came to be known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Sam Dash was majority counsel for the Senate committee that investigated the Nixon administration's Dirty Tricks campaign, the break-in at Democratic Party headquarters, and the subsequent cover-up. Dash shocked the nation when his tenacious probing revealed that President Nixon had secretly taped his conversations. Those tapes would provide the most damning evidence of all. Here's Sam Dash questioning White House aide Alexander Butterfield. The date is July 13, 1973.
If either Mr. Dean, Mr. Haldeman, Mr. Ehrlichman, Mr. Colson had particular meetings in the Oval Office with the President on any particular dates that had been testified before this committee, there would be a tape recording with the President of that full conversation, would there not?
Yes, sir.
If one were, therefore, to reconstruct the conversations at any particular date, what would be the best way to reconstruct those conversations, Mr. Butterfield, in the President's Oval Office?
well, in the obvious manner, Mr. Dash, to obtain the tape and play it.
And joining us to remember Sam Dash and Archibald Cox is the former Republican senator from Connecticut, Lowell Weicker. Welcome, Senator.
Good to be with you, Gail.
Well, I wonder, as you look back some 30 years, how you remember them. Key historical figures, certainly important players in this scandal so long ago.
Well, as far as Archibald Cox was concerned, there was no question about the fact that his arrival on the scene elevated the whole scenario beyond something that was just political. I think a lot of people thought this was a political exercise to bring down Nixon, but I think it became pretty clear that what we were dealing with was a constitutional crisis, and the gravitas that Cox brought to the scene, I think, hammered home that point. Dash's Ford, I think, was putting together a terrific team, especially in the investigative area. Terry Lenzner, Scott Armstrong, these are names that come to mind. And they did a great job even before the tapes came out.
Well, to your point as to the reason for the committee, there's a quote from Archibald Cox where he says that the long-range aim of the Watergate investigation and prosecution was to show that the government could cleanse itself and be put in a shape that the people could trust. Do you think that's what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it was a direct thrust at our Constitution, and as such, it really required our system to go ahead and correct the ills, if indeed the system was up to it. The Watergate Committee, don't forget, really was an investigation of the election of 1972 and the practices of that election. That's what the break-in really related to and the subsequent events. On the other hand, when you got to the matter of the Constitution and what had been violated, this is where the Special Prosecutor's Office came into play. And clearly, when you took a man like Cox and those around him and tried to throw him out, the American people would have none of it. And that, as what's referred to as the Saturday Night Massacre, really, I would say, marked the beginning of the end as far as Nixon was concerned. Regardless of what the committee was going to do, the American people were not going to see that effort thwarted by one individual, specifically Richard Nixon.
There's also a quote here from Sam Dash saying that after the Saturday Night Massacre, he said, "I remember driving back from Alexandria, Virginia at 2 o'clock in the morning, almost weeping, because I realized that we would be exposing the President of the United States as a criminal. It was a tremendous burden." And I wonder what that says to you about the events of that time and also how Dash, as an individual, dealt with them.
Well, I think I can sort of, you know, empathize or relate to Sam's feelings at the time. A lot of people have turned to me and said, you know, you were always anti-Nixon, and the fact was I was not. The president campaigned for me both in my congressional and senatorial elections. And it really took the facts to convince me that this is a very bad man. And it wasn't anything I came with preconceived notions on. I think that's the same thing with Sam. Any of us, we believed in both the office and the man. And I think that at no point was there a partisan attempt by Sam Dash to go ahead and get the nation rid of Nixon. It was strictly motivated by what was uncovered.
Mm. When you think of Archibald Cox, I keep thinking about the bow ties. You know, that seemed to be his trademark.
Well, it was, I myself had a personal experience because the Nixon White House tried to blackmail me with revelations that I had accepted illegal campaign funds, and when they leaked that to the press, I turned the matter right over to Cox and his special prosecutor, saying, "Hey, if there's substance, then let these people make the same determination on me that they make on the president." Well, I got cleared, and that thwarted the blackmail, if you will. But I've always had a rather special place in my heart for Archibald Cox, and the fact that you know, he came to my side when Nixon was trying to do his number on me.
Well, and later when Sam Dash was an advisor to Ken Starr when he was looking into the Lewinsky scandal with Clinton, were you surprised when he agreed to be part of that and then also when he later resigned and said Starr had overstepped his bounds?
You know, I consider that part of the ethos of Sam Dash. I wasn't there for that particular, round. So it's hard for me to say, but I would expect Sam would do that if that was the case.
Do you imagine that we will ever again be confronted with anything quite as dramatic and clear-cut as the Watergate scandal was?
Oh, listen, come on. What's been done to the Constitution of the United States just in the past several years? I'm sorry. I get a little discouraged when I see how cavalier we are with that document and the rights and responsibility imposes on the legislature, the executive judiciary, and us as an American people. So I think you've seen it. Never mind, will we see it? I think you've seen a violation of the Constitution. I think you're seeing it right in the modern-day era.
Mm. Senator Weicker, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Take care now. Bye.
Former Senator Lowell Weicker, remembering Sam Dash and Archibald Cox, both of whom died over the Memorial Day weekend.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, could Latino voters in the U.S. elect the next president?
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Starting today, seniors can begin using new prescription drug discount cards through a partnership with private industry and Medicare. Cards which President Bush says will save seniors 10 to 60% on prescriptions. But choosing which card to use is not easy. Type the name of the cholesterol drug Lipitor, for instance, into the Medicare program's drug card comparison website, and you eventually get 34 discount cards to choose from, some of which cost nothing, some of which have annual enrollment fees of up to $30. Well, on the line to tell us how this is supposed to work is Ron Pollack. He's executive director of Families USA, a health advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. And Ron, we know these cards are a temporary measure until the federal drug benefit kicks in for seniors in 2006. But tell us, how are these cards supposed to work? Who is issuing them?
There are about 73 different cards that are going to be issued mainly by insurance companies, so-called pharmaceutical benefit managers. They are the ones who manage drug plans for HMOs and insurance companies and the like. And they will be the ones who will issue the discount cards to seniors who wish them.
And we understand that the seniors who take them are locked into those cards and the rates for a year.
They are locked into one and only one discount card for an entire year. However, the drug discount card sponsor can switch what drugs are subject to a discount and the size of the discount all of the time. So you, even if you've been able to do your due diligence to find out which card is best for you, you may find in the middle of the year that your drugs are no longer subject to a discount, that the size of the discount has changed, but you're locked into that one card and that card only for the remainder of the year.
Okay, well, let's talk about that due diligence. The process takes place largely online. Another criticism, many seniors don't go online, and it's complicated once they get there. But basically, how does it work on this comparative website?
Well, you place in the website what your zip code is, and then you indicate what drugs you are taking, and then it will indicate which of the discount cards will provide a discount. And then you have to choose among those various cards, and you may say you take four different drugs. You may find one discount card has discounts for two of the drugs, but not for the other two. You may find that another card provides a discount for all of them, but not as good as the discounts for other cards. So you really have to wade through this. Then you can call a 1-800 number, 1-800-MEDICARE. But I will tell you, many people who've tried have not gotten through. When we heard complaints about it, we did our own spot search, and we did over 70 calls. And almost half the time, we did not get through to a live voice.
And on the website itself, there are 60,000 drug products listed. As you said, 73 cards, 50,000 pharmacies around the country. Many people are giving up online. So Ron, does this benefit anyone?
Well, it will help a certain portion of low-income seniors. If you have income, if you're living alone, income below approximately $12,500, or you're a couple, you've income below $16,800, you will benefit because you will get $600 tacked onto your discount card that will help pay for your drugs. However, in some states, they already have a program for low-income seniors. States like Maryland, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Illinois, a number of states have these programs,
right.
And most of those programs are better than the $600 benefit that you receive. And in those states, people are not going to get anything over and above what they have today.
In fact, health officials in Maryland have sent out a letter saying don't sign up for these cards because the state's drug assistance program is better. Well, what about relatively well-off seniors with a lot of drug needs? What are their options? How are they responding to this?
Well, I think this is much ado about very little. We just released a survey last week that looked at the top 30 brand-name drugs, and the prices of those drugs last year rose 4.3 times inflation. Yeah. So the way I analogize this, this is like going to a used car salesman who offers you a $3,000 discount, but before you walked into the showroom, he jacked up the sticker price by $4,000. With these discount cards, people will be paying something like 30, 40, 50% more than what veterans get through the Veterans Administration. That would have been real relief. But unfortunately, the drug companies really ruled this process.
Ron Pollack, thank you.
Delighted to talk to you.
Ron Pollack, Executive Director of Families USA, a health advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. For a link to the government's Medicare website, go to ours, here-now.org.
Well, joining us on the line from the front lines of that prescription drug debate is Robert Skenderian, a pharmacist at Skenderian Apothecary in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Robert, hello.
Hi, Gail. How are you?
Good, thanks. So what are you hearing from your customers about the drug discount card? Are they getting them? Are they using them?
Most of my people who come in here, they ask me about them, and if they have insurance, which most of them do, I tell them it's really a waste of time. I've actually only given out about three of the information packets that were supplied to me to hand out on them for people who didn't have insurance.
Do your customers normally ask you for advice about this sort of thing?
They ask me for advice about insurance all the time.
And what do you tell them?
I usually tell them it depends on what fits in economically. If they need to change their insurance plan because their prescription costs aren't as great as they thought they would be, I have them. I advise them to get less coverage. If they need more, then I tell them to get more. It's really a matter of economics. It's all dollars and cents.
Some consumer groups have done studies showing that many seniors could actually save more money if they shop around on the Internet or if they get their drugs from Canada. Is that the way to go?
If you have no insurance, that probably would be a good way to do things. The problem is, at least in this particular area, is that most people do have some kind of insurance, some Medigap plan that picks up the cost of their prescriptions, or at least a portion of it, and all of those are going to give you better coverage than mailing away or going on the Internet or any other type of insurance of that form.
Is it that clear-cut for you, though? I mean, I would imagine that there are so many individual stories that are perhaps not so easy to resolve.
Actually, most of the time they are pretty clear-cut. In this particular instance, in something like this Medicare card, if you have insurance, you don't need it. If you don't have insurance, but you don't spend very much money, because most of the time, even the chain stores, pretty much every pharmacy offers some kind of discount on their prescriptions. Nobody gets a full markup in this business. The competition's too stiff. So as far as the choice between getting the Medicare card or not, the choice is pretty clear that if you have insurance, don't. And if you do not have insurance and if you don't think you're getting a good deal from your pharmacy, shop around.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Robert Skenderian is a pharmacist at Skenderian Apothecary in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Still to come, Edward Albee on his groundbreaking 1959 one-act play, The Zoo Story, and his recently written companion piece, Home Life.
You're listening to Here and Now.
You might recall the old New Yorker cartoon, the dog sitting at the computer, the caption reading, "On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." Well, that may change. Digital identity, verifying identity on the net, is likely to become a billion-dollar business, and it may keep your credit card safer. But there's also a downside. Our regular information technology commentator, David Weinberger, is here to tell us more. Hello.
Hello.
Well, can we start with a basic question? How anonymous am I if I'm surfing around different internet sites?
You're pretty anonymous. There's information that's passed to every website that you go to that gives them what is your IP address. But that number changes frequently every day, so it's pretty anonymous.
Okay. Well, now tell us about this idea of a possible digital ID. We'll talk in a moment about some specific initiatives, but what generally is a digital ID? What would it do?
Well, that's the problem. There's so many different things that people mean by digital identity. So it ranges from anything from identifying which particular piece of hardware was talking to a website mm-hmm. to making sure that you're the person who you claim you are, and in particular that you're the one who has access to the bank account or the credit card information.
What's the big deal? Why even think of these in the first place? What is the problem that digital IDs are meant to address?
It ranges from the serious, such as identity theft, to matters of convenience, like being able to just do your sign in once and have it work across all the different sites that you go to.
But now I sign in, let's say if I want to buy my groceries on Peapod. Peapod is an online grocery store and delivery service. I have to have a password and I sign on. Why isn't that an ID?
It is an ID. But when you sign on to Peapod, you use one username and password. When you sign on to Amazon, you use another, and so forth. So we are generating dozens and even hundreds of these things. So one of the things that digital ID should do for us, probably, depending on what you mean by it, is mm-hmm. let you sign on once in a session and then not have to sign on again. It may also mean that the different merchants that you deal with who know different things about you, Peapod knows what type of jam you like and Amazon knows which types of books you like, but maybe they, with your permission, can share that information so you don't have to fill out all those forms again.
So this is leading us to some of the different initiatives. Tell us about them.
Well, not too surprisingly, one of the first players in this was, guess who?
Microsoft.
Uh-huh. And how did people react?
They didn't like it.
That's right.
Because it will only work on their software.
That was one issue. The bigger issue is that they were going to be the sole bank holding this information about you. And besides the fact that many people don't trust Microsoft, rightly or wrongly, just the idea of having a single place where all that ID information is kept worried a lot of people. So the major alternative is what's called a federated model. It's a coalition of companies, you know, IBM and Sun and others, which has a different sort of model that says, well, we'll set up a whole bunch of different ID banks that will be able to share information with the user's permission, so it won't all be collected in one vulnerable place.
Is this the slippery slope that people fear? Because if you have these IDs, does this eliminate the anonymity that the internet is so embraced for?
Well, that's exactly the issue, that if you have this infrastructure, you have constructed the slippery slope where it becomes perhaps the default to identify who you are. And there are obviously benefits to that in terms of security and national security. But there's also the flipping of the default on the internet from anonymity to identification. And anonymity has in many ways really shaped the character and the open feeling of the internet.
Well, David, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
David Weinberger, Here and Now's regular information technology commentator. For more on digital IDs, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Brookline, Massachusetts, holds its annual town meeting beginning tonight. The agenda includes a resolution asking parents to refrain from spanking their children. Any resident of Brookline with the support of 10 signatures can get a petition considered at a town meeting. This Spare the Rod measure is sponsored by one Ron Goldman, who does not have children and says he was not spanked as a child. It reads in part, "Whereas the nation's pediatric professionals advise against corporal punishment, and whereas corporal punishment teaches children that violence works, and whereas children, like adults, have the right not to be physically assaulted, and whereas 25% of infants are hit before they are 6 months old, and whereas about 1,200 children die each year from corporal punishment in the United States, and whereas in a study of 8,000 families, children who experience frequent corporal punishment are more likely to physically attack siblings, develop less adequate consciences, experience adult depression, and physically attack a spouse, and whereas this country has extremely high rates of violence compared to other developed countries, now therefore be it resolved that the town meeting encourages parents to refrain from the use of corporal punishment and use alternative, nonviolent methods of discipline and management with an ultimate goal of mutual respect between parent and child." Well, it's too soon to say whether that non-binding resolution will pass. We speak only for our own staff when we say that most times, a good stern talking to will do the trick.
Edward Albee. The name resonates as much as any words he's written. The prickly and provocative playwright has electrified audiences with his brutally honest Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? The Goat, A Delicate Balance. Albee is considered one of the world's most influential living dramatists and the playwright of his generation. But it was Albee's 1959 debut play, The Zoo Story, that first introduced critics and theatergoers to his abrasive style of storytelling. He was in his late 20s. He wrote the groundbreaking one-act piece on an old manual typewriter when he still worked as a messenger for the Western Union Company, turning the typical two strangers meet on a park bench scenario on its head. Here, the button-down Peter is suddenly confronted with the drifter Jerry in Central Park.
"I've been to the zoo. I said I've been to the zoo. Mister, I've been to the zoo."
"What? I'm sorry, were you talking to me?"
Audiences learned a lot about Jerry through his many monologues, but now they have a chance to find out more about Peter. Who was this man on a bench reading a book? Edward Albee's new companion piece, Home Life, takes us into Peter's life and introduces us to his wife of 20 years, all of them inside Edward Albee's head until now.
"Before I married you, my mother said to me, why ever would you want to marry a man who publishes textbooks?
She did not.
Well, she could have, and maybe she did. Why ever would you want to marry a man who publishes textbooks? Gee, Ma, I don't know. Seems like fun.
Thought your family liked me."
"They do. He's a good, solid man, Dad said. I've told you this. None of this fly-by-night fiction stuff."
Home Life and The Zoo Story are currently being staged together at the Hartford Stage in Connecticut, which commissioned the new piece. We spoke to Edward Albee on opening day.
"I'm always afraid on opening night the sets will fall down or the audience will come in late and start talking and yelling. And I hate opening nights for that reason."
And tell us about it, how it came to be. Was it in your mind, decades ago when you wrote Zoo Story?
I had always been thinking that it might be interesting if the audience knew more about the character Peter. If they only knew the zoo story, and everything we know about Peter in the zoo story is determined by what Jerry thinks about Peter. Mm-hmm. But I've always known there was a little bit more to Peter than that. So when this commission from the Hartford Stage Company came up, this struck me as being a very interesting opportunity to give us a 45-minute play about Peter at home with his wife, Anne, so he would understand more who he was when we saw him in the second half of the evening in the park with Jerry.
And for those who haven't read their Zoo Story lately...
That'll be even better, because they'll be approaching the entire thing fresh without any preconceptions.
But can you remind us, they might remember, Peter was the one on the bench first, and Jerry was the one who came along and tried to engage him in conversation
You're
about
right.
a zoo.
You're right.
But what did Jerry think of Peter?
he thought he was a bit of a middle-brow, middle-class, button-down type that really didn't understand what life was all about. And I think there's a little more to Peter than that.
So we're going to learn more about Peter. Can you tell us anything we might learn that might help us understand why he couldn't react more for Jerry?
Well, no, you're going to learn first, most importantly, that he is a three-dimensional person, not the two-dimensional caricature that Jerry seems to think that he is.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're going to learn about him is who he is. We're going to learn enough about Peter to understand why he behaves the way he does in the zoo story.
Yeah. I was reading your biography. It's called A Singular Journey. It's by Mel Gussow. And in it you say, you don't like to say what your plays are about, but I'm going to cheerfully and perhaps foolishly ask you anyway. What was that about, that encounter on the bench?
What was it about?
Yeah.
It was about one man trying to persuade another man that there's more to life than getting through it comfortably and easily, and there's more to life than social and psychological demands for one person to another, and that we should live life rather than just skid through it.
The zoo story exploded into the theater scene. Much was made at the time about who these two men were.
These are two characters that I invented.
But you know, many people wondered, was this you? Was this two sides of you?
They would be totally wrong.
Yeah.
I don't write autobiography. I've never written about me, ever. I'm a fairly interesting person, but I'm not a dramatic subject. And I write plays that are dramatic with dramatic characters, and so I invent.
Suddenly it feels as if Edward Albee is very much back in the spotlight. How are you feeling
about
that?
Well, you just wait 5 years, I'll be invisible again. These things come in waves. You're popular for a while, then you're unpopular, then you're popular again. It shifts back and forth. You shouldn't worry about it.
How do you feel, though, about the fact that you have a new piece out? And does it ever change? I mean, you said you don't like opening nights, but part of that is that critics are also going to be receiving it.
Well, I know how I feel about the work, and I just hope that the critics share my view of it.
Well, speaking of critics, as I said, they look to find you in your plays. I'm thinking about another one, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? You are openly gay.
Yeah, but the play has nothing to do with gay people.
I know, but people have wanted to push you to say that it is and even want to reinterpret the play.
People are stupid and arrogant. I have closed several productions of the play where they try to make it about two male people. I've closed them down because that's not what the play is about.
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to write a play about a gay couple, I'd do it. I wouldn't disguise it.
Yeah. You spoke recently at Emerson College here in Boston, and you advise aspiring playwrights to slug audiences in the face with theater.
Well, of course. I don't think that theater should be... It should be an experience of some sort. You're going to spend a bunch of money to go to the theater. Something should happen to you. You just shouldn't sit there and hum or smile weakly and then leave and forget what you've seen. Theater should be a forceful dramatic act.
But, you know, in this day and age, there are, you know, possibly some young people saying, okay, let's see, there are a man and his wife in the first play, and then there's a second play, there's two guys sitting on a bench. And this is a generation that's grown up with unbelievable images, and they're pounded every day by images. And
well, that's one of the interesting things about live theater, that it's an intellectual engagement, and you don't need all of that technological crap all the time.
I was thinking this morning, you know, and I've been thinking a lot, an American was beheaded last week. We saw these incredible images. You know, most people have
An American was beheaded, yes, and 650 American soldiers have been killed since President Bush said the war was over.
Right.
Yeah, what's your question?
Well, and people have sort of, you know, moved on from a lot of those images to the next week's images because they can't hold them in their head anymore. And I just, how do you get people to stop and pay attention?
Well, you just have to be interesting enough so that they will stop and pay attention. You know, I wish people would spend more time thinking about why we're in Iraq and what did we get there for the right reason and why are all these hundreds of Americans being killed rather than just going from one flash sensationalist image to another.
Would you ever write about that, or is that just something that personally bugs you?
I will probably write about it very indirectly.
Well, Edward Albee, a pleasure to speak to you, and good luck at your opening.
Thank you.
Home Life, Edward Albee's new companion piece to his classic 1959 play, The Zoo Story, is now being staged at the Hartford Stage. And this Thursday, here and now's theater critic Bill Marks will have a review.
Here and now, a production of WBUR.
Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.